The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, joined today by Todd Zwillick. Merry Christmas Eve, Todd.
Merry Christmas to you, John, and to you, listeners, however you celebrate. Thank you for listening. This hour, we talk to a lawyer representing three Syrian refugee families detained in Texas. And on the biggest movie release day of the year, the Movie Date crew is here, Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman.
And we'll welcome Sean Ramaswaram back for a special holiday Thursday 5.
But we begin this hour with a look at Cuba. It's been a year of big change in the relationship between the United States and Cuba. One thing that hasn't changed yet, though, is the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy. That allows Cubans who make it to the United States, the actual dry land of the United States, to get residency after just 1 year. For more on that policy and a look at the current flow of Cubans to the U.S., we turn to Mark Rosenblum. He's deputy director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute.
Cuba is definitely completely unique of all countries in the world, primarily with that wet foot, dry foot policy that you mentioned, which says, essentially, as it's been implemented, which says that any Cuban who reaches U.S. soil is paroled into the country and becomes eligible to apply for a green card a year after arrival. It's the only country that gets treated like that. And it's also the only country that has a guaranteed minimum number of permanent residents that are admitted each year. In addition to immediate family members, the U.S. promises Cuba that at least 20,000 Cubans can come legally to the U.S. each year.
Now, let's be clear. The peculiarities that we're talking about, all of them owe to the legacy of making Castro look bad, right? That's why it's different than any other country. If you can get out of Cuba, get your feet to Florida, you're in.
Right. It's definitely a legacy of the Cold War. It dates back to the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, which passed, you know, about 7 years after the Cuban Revolution. And I think that's right. It was in large part to make Castro look bad. And also at the time, based on the idea that people fleeing Cuba were, by definition, political refugees who were fleeing a repressive communist regime.
All right. And now that those relations are warming, now that the Cold War is over and we're no longer necessarily referring to Cuba as a repressive regime, I mean, we've all seen the news. We're warming up relations. We're normalizing things. This policy is going to have to change, right?
It certainly seems anachronistic and hard to defend. I mean, it's based on the presumption that Cuba is uniquely repressive, that people fleeing Cuba are uniquely eligible for refugee status. And when you look around the world, I mean, certainly there are still real problems in Cuba, and there are political prisoners. But when you look around the world, or even when you look around the hemisphere, there are plenty of other countries where people are fleeing, you know, arguably more difficult conditions and have a greater claim to being refugees. And then with relations warming, it's also true that regular travel, legal travel, is increasing. And it's difficult to have people regularly visiting the U.S. from Cuba as long as we have that Cuban Adjustment Act in place, because it's easy for them essentially to defect. And once they're here, you know, to apply to become permanent residents and eventually U.S. citizens.
Right. I mean, if you're going to keep the same policy and it becomes easier to travel and you don't have to make a raft as long as you have the money to get across the straits there to Key West or to Miami, then it's completely self-defeating, because if any Cuban that can scrape the money together can fly to the U.S., which they'll be able to do before long, you've got a problem.
You know, the other thing that we're already seeing is that, you know, since relations have been normalized, Cubans recognize that this program, you know, may be on its way to being phased out. And so we've seen a huge increase in the last year in Cubans traveling illegally to the U.S., mostly by flying to Ecuador and then traveling by land through Central America and through Mexico and reaching the U.S. Those numbers have increased like fourfold in the last 5 years, and mostly just in the last year, as Cubans seek to take advantage of the Cuban Adjustment Act while it still exists.
And while it still exists, we've seen the U.S. ambassador or the U.S. representative say in the pages of the New York Times and maybe elsewhere that policy's not changing anytime soon, the Cuban Adjustment Act policy. I mean, he sort of has to say that, right?
Right. He certainly can't say we're revisiting that and it may phase out, because then, you know, that's really an invitation to Cubans to get in while the getting's good. So I think, you know, we'll continue to see officials, you know, in both countries say that, that this arrangement is not being negotiated until the day that, that it goes away.
Mark Rosenblum, let's parse the politics here for 1 second, because there's just such a remarkable difference when you look at, say, the reaction that many Americans have had towards Syrian refugees and the prospect of even 10,000 refugees from a place like Syria coming to the United States. At the same time, we have a policy, as we've discussed, that lets any Cuban who can reach U.S. shores have a green card and stay. But at the same time, until, I don't know, 6 months ago, Cuba was on the official state sponsor's list of terrorism. But nobody's worried about those Cubans being terrorists. Talk about the contrast.
I think, as you said, it's very much a function of politics and of the strong Cuban constituencies in South Florida and elsewhere that elect members of Congress who represent their immigration interests and represent a strong voting bloc really solidly around these immigration issues. So it's hard to look at the different standards for Cubans versus Syrians or for Cubans versus Central Americans and justify them sort of based on objective reality. It's very much a function of the politics.
Relations are changing between the United States and Cuba, and there are going to be lots of hot flashpoints along the way, the embargo and also the intricacies of immigration policy between the United States and Cuba. Mark Rosenblum is Deputy Director of U.S. Immigration Policy at the Migration Policy Institute. Mark Rosenblum, thank you.
Thank you.
President Obama inaugurated the holiday season with the suggestion next year in Havana. After starting the process of normalizing relations with Cuba all this year, he wants to complete the job and visit Cuba before he leaves office. If he makes it, he'll be visiting a much more Catholic country, where the church, long scorned by the Communist Party, is coming out into the sunlight. What's it like to be living as a Catholic in Cuba right now? For that, we turn to a lifelong Catholic who was born and raised in Havana following the revolution.
Not everything is fine, but people are suspecting that a little bit these steps could bring better opportunities for the Cuban people.
How has the Catholic Church been at the center of these changes?
Involved, because both presidents, you know, they expressed their gratitude to the Holy Father, Pope Francis, who got involved in this process that both government previously had started in a secret way. But I think it shows the goodwill of the church to bring together two countries that for many years were separated by confrontations and hate and Cold War, etc. And even before the Pope Francis got involved in this process, the bishops' conference, both in the U.S. and also in Cuba, many times made this kind of request to both governments in order to bring peace to both people, especially the Cuban people, small people, and with families separated for many years, because many of the Cuban families live in the U.S., or even in other countries, and part of the family remaining here, separated by confrontations, by policy, by ideology, by all these situations. And we expected for many years this moment that was a great moment for us last year.
How has that changed the identity of the church in Cuba? Are people coming back to the Catholic Church in their cultural lives?
Let's say this, for example. Catholic Church in Cuba and Catholic practitioners in Cuba, we are a minority in this country. On the other hand, after the visit of three popes, people are rediscovering, if I can say that, the origin of their faith and are removing the dust that for many years was covering that faith, and is recognizing every day the possibilities of the church and the work of the church in the society.
Orlando, you lived through those years of dust and the church really hiding and not being a part of mainstream culture. What was that like?
Well, it was because of the atheist program were prepared from the government, from the instance of the government. Cuba was part of the Soviet line, Soviet group during the Cold War, and atheism was part of the system, and the believers and faith was seen like something from the past that should be left behind. But it failed, because you cannot remove the faith of the people just because of a decree or something like that. There were tough years indeed. We knew what it was to suffer some kind of pressure, be under pressure, not in the same way as in some countries in Eastern Europe, because the church no matter the pressure, was never prohibited in Cuba. And yes, it's true, some priests were expelled. Some others who were studying abroad never received the permission to get into the country again. And the number of priests fell down in a huge way. But anyway, those who decided, many Catholics left the country also, this migration that hasn't stopped yet, especially to the U.S., but many Catholics decided to stay here. I was a child in the 60s, and I remember every Sunday when I went to Mass, a new stained glass was broken by a stone thrown from a Bronx, etc. But anyway, we continued attending Mass, etc. I grew up as Catholic, as many others, my friend. We knew from the moment that we are a small group. But anyway, we live in this society. In the end, I think we gained the respect of those who were among us.
Orlando, what's your greatest hope looking forward?
Well, it's not easy to talk about happiness, but my greatest hope is see the Cuban people recovering their own life and having a normal and better life. This is my greatest hope. I think we are in the process. There is a long way to go yet, and many things, not only the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. Could bring a better opportunity, but more steps must be taken within the country. Huge steps must be taken within the country, giving more opportunity to the Cuban people, to the Cuban population, to express and bring about with the armed capabilities and possibilities of in the good of this country.
Orlando, it's really great to speak with you, and have a great holiday.
The same for you, sir.
Orlando Marquez Hidalgo, who's director of the Catholic monthly magazine Palabra Nueva of the Archdiocese of Havana. It's Christmas Eve on The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The spirit of generosity and amnesty that often goes with this holiday seems to be eluding some officials in Texas. Three Christian families whose long journey from Syria to America is nearly over, but may miss Christmas this year. Texas is a state that has fought hard against the resettlement of Syrian refugees, and for now that means these three families are caught in a political vice. They can't go forward beyond their detention centers in southern Texas, and they certainly can't go back to Syria. Jonathan Ryan is the executive director of RAICES, the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, based in San Antonio, Texas.
The circumstances are pretty dire for these families. They are not in the same detention center. They were split up immediately after handing themselves over to immigration officials at the border. The fathers were sent to a for-profit prison for men, and the mothers and children were sent to a new for-profit prison that's specifically for women and children.
As far as we know, what was their path to get here to the United States?
These folks took their lives into their hands, had to put their fates in the hands of a smuggler, costing tens of thousands of dollars to get them out of Syria and on the long, circuitous journey to Mexico, after which they finally took a taxi to the bridge in Laredo and handed themselves over to U.S. immigration officials.
So they crossed the border and immediately handed themselves over and put themselves up for asylum. In normal circumstances, if someone didn't cross the border, I know there are a number of resettlement agencies there in Texas. Are they typically advising people to go to a particular border and then the resettlement process starts at that point?
Well, to be clear, the resettlement of refugees is a lengthy process that is conducted by the Department of State. These are individuals who fled active violence and who are requesting asylum, which means they're requesting refugee status from the border from a U.S. immigration judge. The process is different and much, much more rigorous. These are people who at any moment feel that they could be returned right back into that battle zone from whence they fled. They are not like the refugees in a camp that are being resettled by the Department of State. That's a much cozier process.
The bar is higher for them, which is a little bit confusing because in many ways their circumstances are more dire than the people who might be in the camps and have been away from violence for a while. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly right. You know, our country's heart broke a few months ago at the images of a Syrian child whose family tried to escape the violence and that child ended up drowning. That is these families. They are fleeing the exact same violence. unfortunately, because of the changing tides of our political discourse and our news cycle, rather than protecting these very same people that we hold up as refugees, in fact, we're prosecuting them. We're putting them in prisons, and our government, our administration, President Obama himself is doing everything he can to deport them.
Jonathan, what steps would you anticipate the government would be taking at this point to try to determine that these individuals are not a threat? Is there anything left to be done? Is there any background that needs to be checked here? Does the government have all the information it needs? What's your understanding?
That's one of the ironies of the situation, is that this family has actually passed every test that the government has given them. They've undergone lengthy interviews with our asylum office and all been found to actually have a positive, credible fear of returning back to Syria. They have undergone background checks through the FBI, Interpol, and probably about a dozen other federal agencies, and have been found to pose no security risk, no flight risk, and have all been found to have strong asylum cases, both by the asylum office and by our lawyers. So they've passed every test. It seems to be some other pressure or some other reason that we're not being told why the government has kept them in detention.
So, Jonathan, let me get this straight. The U.S. government's position is to condemn Islamic radicalism in Syria, to condemn ISIS's treatment of Syrian Christians in Syria. Yet here are three Syrian families in detention in the United States. They've passed all the tests for getting asylum, and they can't be released in time for Christmas?
That's right. And let me be very clear about this. Their religion has no bearing on their eligibility for asylum. I've represented hundreds of asylum seekers who are Muslim, who are Christian. All religions qualify for asylum if they are fleeing persecution. It just so happens in this particular case that we have a president and an administration that has called upon our better angels as a nation, has evoked our past as a nation of immigrants, as one that has led the world in the protection of refugees. Yet on the ground, in the execution of policy, what we see is that the government is making every attempt to detain them, to potentially deport them back to Syria, and holding these families apart with no interaction. The husband has no idea how his children are faring, how his wife is doing. And so it's a real unfortunate irony that there seems to be a gulf between the stated policy of the administration and the way that things actually work on the ground.
Now, you speak very eloquently, and Jonathan, you're familiar with speaking to the media. So, your evocations of images of babies washing up on the shore, that's all fine, and there's nothing incorrect about any of that. But, is there some reason that I don't understand why these individuals are still in custody? Is there some sort of red tape issue here that you can tell me about to help illuminate this? Because it does seem completely at odds with everything that the president is saying.
I really cannot think of a good reason. What we know is that these families were originally scheduled to be released. In fact, their family members in the United States were contacted to purchase airplane tickets for them to depart Texas and travel to be with their families. Immediately after the unfortunate events in San Bernardino, however, their families were called and told to cancel those tickets. So it does appear that there was a process through which they should have been released, but that outside forces, unfortunately, politics, news cycles, is what's keeping these people in detention right now. There is a mass, I think, hysteria. There is a paranoia afoot, and these folks, unfortunately, are falling prey to that.
Jonathan Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Jonathan Ryan is executive director of RAISES, the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, based in San Antonio.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and boy, oh boy, do we have a holiday gift for you. Five of them, actually. Cultural freak and holiday sweater purveyor Shyam Ramaswaram is back with a special five. He sat down with John Hockenberry.
I brought you five songs that won't make you want to jump off a bridge this holiday season.
Sounds very good.
Yeah.
Number one.
Number one. It's a little late, but Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings put out a great record of holiday music, and it features a Hanukkah song. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Huh? You can guarantee that I won't want to jump out a window? Number two. Oh,
we're off to a bad start.
Number two.
The Killers put out a Christmas song every year. This year's installment is called Dirt Sledding, and it features a cameo by, guess, Richard Dreyfuss.
You know, it's nice to see you wrapped up. See how far you've come. There's something to be said for being present, not just getting one. So pass the gravy and tap your toes. And don't mind old Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Oh my God.
Gravitas.
It's Dickie Dreyfuss and the Killers. There is life after Jaws.
Every holiday song should feature Richard Dreyfuss. Okay, number three. Yeah, have you heard of Fetty Wap?
Of course.
Fetty Wap was everywhere this year. He's the New Jersey rapper, had a huge, huge year. He was also brought up on Taylor Swift's stage during one of her, like, look at my famous friends moments this year, which is weird because his biggest song is about cooking drugs in a kitchen. Anyway, he's taken a victory lap by closing out the year with a jam called, appropriately, Merry Xmas. All Fetty Wap songs sound the same, but this one is about Christmas. There's a slight lyrical tweak there.
I get it. I completely get it. It's very, very evocative of Christmas.
Sure.
Yes. Number four.
Did you watch the Bill Murray Netflix Christmas holiday special thing?
No, I didn't.
Bill Murray teamed up with the Sofia Coppola there, invited a bunch of his famous friends, mostly Paul Schaefer's hanging out the whole time, but then Chris Rock and Amy Poehler and George Clooney and Miley
Cyrus. But it's reunited
Cyrus.
From Lost in Translation.
Sort of, yeah. But the idea is Bill Murray's like trying to celebrate the holidays and needs help from his friends. And he sings a lot. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Phoenix, the band Phoenix from the France, the singer's married to Sofia Coppola. That's the connection there. They do a collaborative song with Bill Murray, and it's beautiful. And I brought that for you, too. Do you hate that one? Is that okay? Was that
You're fun? A nut and I love you. Now get out of here. No, that's great. That's good. Okay, I like that. That's good. Number five.
Sure. Number five. This one's a little different, John. A group in Sweden called Action Aid Sweden. It's a not-for-profit organization, a charitable organization. They put out an album of holiday music, and instead of people singing the songs, we have goats. It's goats.
Of course we do.
Would you believe that it's for a good cause?
Yeah, what are they trying to raise money for with this?
They're trying to raise awareness about the important role goats play in fighting poverty, and that's actually not a joke.
How did you run into this?
The internet.
The internet. Which is why we love you, Sean Ramaswaram, resident Christmas expert at WNYC. Soon you'll be the resident Easter expert at WNYC. Yeah. We'll have you back.
I aspire. Yeah.
Sean, happy holidays.
Same to you, John. Have a good time. Good time.
Much performed, much parodied, much hummed and whistled, there would be no classical ballet without the Sugar Plum Fairy Waltzing Snowflake Drosselmeyer Mouse King pageantry called the Nutcracker Suite. Did you know that 40% of the revenue of most ballet companies in the United States comes in during the Nutcracker Suite around Christmas time? And in the more than a century since Tchaikovsky gave us the unstoppable Nutcracker, there have been some prodigious imitators and knockoffs, but for the last 2 years, there has been the option to experience the hip-hop Nutcracker from the Decadence Theater Company and the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. Jennifer Weber is the choreographer of the hip-hop Nutcracker. She's right here in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you merge the classical music with the dance style that you describe as hip-hop? How did that work?
We just started, you know, with the score itself and with the story of the Nutcracker, and then we started reimagining it through the language of hip-hop because that's the language that I speak as a choreographer and with the dancers as well. So we just started with listening and figuring out ways to translate those sounds into our bodies and into our language.
The music doesn't feel hip-hop to me. It seems like it would be quite a challenge.
It is a challenge, but, you know, that's, like, the thing about hip-hop is, like, you're always wanting a challenge. You're wanting to push yourself as an artist and to see, like, where you can push the language of hip-hop in new directions. So hip-hop is a vocabulary, and it doesn't need to be connected to hip-hop music. It can really be connected to any sort of story and any sort of music that you want. And I find the Tchaikovsky score so inspiring and so beautiful. And, you know, it really just took on a new life when we started setting hip-hop choreography to those sounds.
So much of the Nutcracker is in three, and so much hip-hop dance is in a four or a two beat. How did that work for you?
It's challenging. Yeah. I mean, you know, just counting the Tchaikovsky is so hard, you know. But the thing that's so cool is because hip-hop is usually in a two or a four, it becomes very predictable. Like, you can feel the accent before you even do the move. And with Tchaikovsky, you can't. So there's this element of surprise that really adds so much to the hip-hop world.
And is the story the same? How would you do the synopsis versus what the classical story is?
It's very close. The first act itself is very close. It takes place in New York City at a block party in Washington Heights. It takes place today. And we sort of follow Maria Clara as she meets the Nutcracker, as they fall in love, and her parents are sort of feuding at the block party. And in the second act, when we go into the Land of Sweets, it's actually a nightclub, and Drosselmeyer leads them into this club, and we see Mom and Dad on the night they met in the 80s, and all those scenes in the second act are all sort of like throwbacks to old school 80s hip hop.
So it's the 80s. So it's like Run DMC is like cruising around.
In Movement. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. How do audiences respond to this show?
It's amazing to see audiences respond to the show. It's such a diverse audience. You get people who love hip hop, people who love ballet, people who are, you know, just looking for a new holiday tradition for their family, and everybody's jamming. I think everyone really starts to feel the groove of the Tchaikovsky in a whole new way. And we also have Curtis Blow, who's a legendary old school hip hop MC, and he really starts the show off. So we have people like, they're totally jamming to Curtis Blow, and then they're totally jamming to Tchaikovsky, and it's so cool to watch that.
And this year you're on tour.
Yes.
And describe your tour.
The tour is going all over the U.S. We went to Miami. We're going to North Carolina. We just got back from South Carolina. And then at the end of the tour, we're going to be heading to Moscow.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a really big hip-hop scene in Russia.
Sure.
So, you know, I think it's going to be really well-received. It just feels, you know, we're sort of like taking this Russian classic with an American twist and bringing it back to the homeland. And it's just a really cool opportunity to, you know, to share our vision and our interpretation of this piece with that audience.
Have you done anything to change the music at all? In other words, visually, when we see the performance, what is it we're seeing?
We actually have a DJ on stage. We also have an electric violinist. And we do have a couple scenes within the show where we remix the Tchaikovsky score. So we sort of loop it. Our DJ, his name is DJ Boo. He created a bunch of original beats. But we use it very specifically in the show to change location. So whenever the action changes from the party to the park, for example, we go into these hip-hop remixes. So we have, you know, a bit of a hip-hop sound in addition to the classical sound.
Jennifer Weber is the choreographer of the Hip Hop Nutcracker on its way to Moscow this holiday season. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Yes, Christmas Eve, one of the biggest movie days of the year. All those Oscar contenders, the blockbusters, the indies. This year, seven big releases. We're not going to have time to get through all of them, but we'll cover as many as we can with our Movie Date team. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hi, Todd.
And Kristen Meinzer, of course, culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi, Todd.
Special Christmas movie trivia. You knew this was coming. I'm very excited. It's going to be audio, of course. You're going to hold your answer before we get to all of your movies. We'll come back to the answer at the end. This is a special Christmas version. I bring you back to National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Clark Griswold, in a pivotal moment of this film, is looking forward to his Christmas bonus.
I can't believe it.
What is it? A letter confirming your reservation at the Nut House?
Your bonus.
My bonus.
Clark Griswold's Christmas bonus. What is it? That's the trivia. Hold on to that, and you're going to get that back at the very end of the segment. You guys are shaking your heads. Now, Kristen, Rafer, first out of the gates for Christmas Eve, Concussion. This is Will Smith. Of course, this is about the NFL. Let's listen to a clip.
Your men continue to die. Their families left in ruins.
truth. Tell the truth.
I have to confess, I love that trailer so much. I walk around all the time going, tell the truth. I say it all the time. It's just fantastic. Kristen, how does it shape up?
So this is Will Smith playing the real Dr. Bennett Amalu, who is a Nigerian pathologist. He begins investigating the deaths and the brain damage of multiple former NFL players and finds that this brain damage is coming from concussions, from repeated blows to the head. And he says that this is much worse than the NFL is letting the public believe or letting the players believe, and that it's time that we're honest, that we tell the truth, as you say.
So does it reach the cultural relevance that it's going for?
I think it does. I think it's a very straightforwardly told film in that sense. Nothing very flashy or very standout about the way it's telling the story. But I do think it's pretty remarkable to see a Hollywood film like this take on one of America's most cherished institutions. Usually when you have a little guy, big guy film, they're taking on somebody that we're already all, you know, prepped to hate, like the tobacco company or something.
Or Wall Street.
Exactly, right? We all hate those guys already. This is football. And the movie, I will say, goes after the NFL and the game of football very hard and pulls no punches. And I was very surprised by that.
Okay, Joy, David O. Russell is back with some of his favorite cast members, Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, of course, Robert De Niro. Let's listen.
You said to me that David Selznick, the son of immigrants, married Jennifer Jones, an all-American girl from Oklahoma, because in America, all races and all classes can meet and make whatever opportunities they can. And that is what you feel when you reach into people's homes with what you sell.
Well, this hits me right in my wheelhouse because I work for Newsday, which is a Long Island paper, and this is based on Joy Mangano, who's a Long Island housewife who created the Miracle Mop and became a multi-millionaire. It's a bit of a mess the way David O. Russell films can be. Very energetic, very fun, and enjoyable. What works about the film for me is that it's a very American story, and he tells it in a very sincere way. He doesn't have any condescension toward this housewife and her terrific mop. He's really invested in this character, and Jennifer Lawrence, of course, I think plays her very well.
Kristen, it seems like Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper are going to keep hitting home runs until somebody stops pitching to them, I guess.
I think so, and this is a big crowd pleaser. It's hard not to get behind this character, Joy. She's working class. She's got the worst family in the world. They're all lazy. They're all leeches. They're all taking advantage of each other. They're all horrible. And she's just a hardworking, inventive, smart woman who doesn't want to be caught up in what she came from, but move forward with all of her ideas. And it's hard not to cheer for her. I agree with you, Rafer. A lot of this is a mess. And yet, despite that, I just found her so likable.
Now, one of the scariest and grittiest trailers out there this fall leading up to the holiday season has been The Revenant with Leonardo DiCaprio. Listen.
All I had was my boy. And he took him from me, you understand? He's afraid. He knows how far I came to find him.
This is based on a real character, Hugh Glass, that existed back in the fur trading era in Canada and the northern United States. He has a horrible, horrible encounter with a bear. He has horrible encounters with Native Americans. His team leaves him for dead. He has to survive. He has to hopefully get revenge on the man who killed his son. And a lot of this movie is just quiet survival scenes, no dialogue, him trying to stay alive in a brutal winter. And while it is sometimes very compelling, it also is a little bit too slow for my taste. It's a little bit too repetitive. And I had some issues with the depictions of Native Americans.
Rafer, this is the kind of film where you're out in the wilderness along with the protagonist fighting, scrapping, suffering. It's really gritty. At least that's the impression I get.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've nailed it. And I think Leonardo DiCaprio, who plays the lead role, Hugh Glass, is very good. And it's a role that doesn't require much dialogue. It's mostly screaming in pain. It's very intense. The filmmaking, I will say, is so incredible. The action scenes, many of them are shot in a single take. I have no idea how they did it. This is Iñárritu, the director who did Birdman. Kristen is right. It can be a little repetitive. There's a lot of shots of DiCaprio eating raw meat. But I do think that this film is a great time at the movies and just an amazing physical sensory experience.
Well, if you like raw meat and a lot of spurting blood in your movies, you'll love Quentin Tarantino, who is out with The Hateful Eight.
Banging desperate men in their lives is a good way to get yourself dead.
You can't catch me sleeping if I don't close my eyes.
I don't want to work that hard.
No one said the job's supposed to be easy.
No one said it's supposed to be that hard, neither.
Rafer Guzman, I think I was listening to Samuel L. Jackson and Kurt Russell there.
That is correct. They're in a stagecoach. They're heading through Wyoming. They're going to get trapped in a blizzard in Minnie's Haberdashery with some unsavory, possibly questionable types. The screenplay just doesn't work. Mm. And for a three-hour movie, that's a lot of not working to sit through. And I have to say, I was disappointed in this Tarantino film. I think it's his weakest yet.
I have to say, not only is this the worst Tarantino movie ever, it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. The way this movie is set up for the first two-thirds of it, it's just some people you cannot stand talking about nothing at all, blabbing on and on and on and on. Then there's an intermission, and then you get sort of a payoff. But to me, it's not worth sitting through the horrible part to get to the end. It's just not worth it.
I got two bad reviews there for The Hateful Eight from Quentin Tarantino. Now, we only got to four films. There are a lot more that's going to be on the podcast this week.
Yes, that includes Daddy's Home and Where to Invade Next. So, yeah, listen to this podcast this week to hear the rest.
That's all in the Movie Date podcast. Let's get to trivia before I let you go to open your stockings. I asked you in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation when Clark W. Griswold finally gets his Christmas bonus. What is it, Kristen?
I have absolutely no idea. I wish it was tickets to Wally World, though.
Rafer?
I don't know. I don't know, Todd.
It's a one-year membership in the Jelly of the Month Club.
Oh, God. Clark, that's the gift that keeps on giving the whole year.
Poor Clark.
Poor Clark.
He wanted his big bonus for his work on that non-nutritive cereal varnish. And look, all he got was the Jelly of the Month Club. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer here at The Takeaway, the Movie Date team. Merry Christmas, you guys.
You too, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. This is Todd Zwillick. This fall, we introduced you to some of the students from El Paso Community College. Now, EPCC is one of the five schools we're featuring in our Community College Challenge. Earlier this month, students from El Paso's forensic debate team swung by our studios while they were in town for a tournament. Crystal, Diego, Charles, and Sean sat down with John Hockenberry to talk about the competition and give us just a little taste of their dramatic interpretations.
Welcome to The Takeaway, you guys.
Hello. Hello.
Well, thank you.
And congratulations. A little bit on edge here at the finals, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Who's your competition?
Various community colleges and universities that we're going up against this weekend. Just a bunch from local around New York and then from all over the nation, actually.
Is this a community college competition or is this college?
And universities. Yes. It's hosted by community college, but a bunch of universities and community colleges all come out from all around the nation. It's how all regular tournaments work throughout the country.
All right. So community college doesn't mean a thing in this competition, right, Crystal?
Right.
So how did you get started in this? And when you were, did you grow up in El Paso?
Yes, I did.
All right. So did you think you'd ever be involved in something like this?
No, never. I always thought I'd be theater, but speech and debate never came to my mind. But when I joined it, I really enjoyed it.
What else did you want to get out of community college? And how big of a deal is EPCC in your community?
Well, in our community, EPCC is kind of a big deal because, of course, we're on the border. So we get many people coming across just for school, trying to make better lives for themselves. And with community colleges throughout the nation, it just lowers the prices. It's not as expensive as the universities. And I think that's huge because I probably wouldn't be at a university just because it is too expensive for me and my family. But with community colleges, they offer that you can get the same education as you can at a university for like a third of the price.
So are you all prepared to be starving artists?
Yes, we are prepared. Hopefully we won't have to be. We get a great education at EPCC. They prepare us as best they can for the real world, especially in the theater aspect. Our summer repertory, we handle all aspects of theater from the marketing, tech aspects, performing on stage. We do it all at EPCC. They really get us ready at El Paso Community College.
Diego, how did you pick your interpretive reading?
Well, throughout the summer when we're doing our shows, our coaches pull us aside and talk to us like, hey, what do you think about doing this piece or doing this, looking at some literature? And so they found out who you are. They get to talk to you. They get to know you. And based off that, they get to see, okay, well, he would be good for this kind of thing. So like me, Sal Mineo, I had to watch Holly's interviews, and just knowing what he went through was just...
You knew nothing about Salminio before.
I did. I watched Rebel Without a Cause. And it was, like, based on that, yeah, of course, you're like, oh, wow, James Dean is amazing. But then when you're like, wait, Salminio was good, too. Who's Salminio? You know?
So your interpretive reading is imagining Salminio speaking to the audience?
It's more like Salminio confessing his real feelings that he could never do until, you know, when James passed away. Now, Rebel Without a Cause, now that was a goddamn movie, am I right? I had the honor of playing John Plato Smith, you know? A man who has the eyes for Jimmy. Oh, that's what you have to say. No, you can't say that I'm in love with him or that a man loves another man, no. You have to say, Plato has the eyes for Jim Stock. You know, Hollywood and their bullcrap. Oh, I'm sorry, but it's true. You know, I got sick and tired of them locking me in any place they could find a key to. So what? Who cares? It's just sex, people. At least that's what I would say.
Nice. Nice. Crystal, can you outdo that?
Sure.
Yes.
During my career, I earned the reputation of an agent who fought for my clients, who wasn't afraid to take on the big boys. Well, you see, the trickle of clients, darling, becomes a flood. So Gene Hackman comes Candy Bergen, Mike Nichols, Michael Caine, George Siegel, Herbert Ross, Anthony Newley, Diane Cannon, Bob Fosse, Cindy Lumen, Sybil Shepherd, on and on. So in the blink of an eye, darling, I am living the life that I have always dreamed about.
And who is that?
Sue Mengers.
The agent?
The agent, yes.
So you're imagining her speaking to the audience?
I imagine her talking to a prodigy of an agent who wants to become an agent.
Oh, that's so great. That's so great. How about you?
Well, my DI is actually All the Way, the play about Lyndon Baines Johnson. That's my DI that I'm doing. That's similar to what their pieces are.
What DIA is?
DI is dramatic interpretation.
Dramatic interpretation.
Yes.
That's your DI. Mm-hmm. And give me a little sense of it and then tell me a little bit about it.
You want me to perform a little?
Yeah.
Spot? Okay. I'm going to tell you all the story of the first job I got coming out of college. It was teaching first grade elementary school in Cotulla, Texas. It's this dirt poor town in the middle of nowhere full of wetback Mexicans who have a pot to piss in. Oh, but goddamn, I love those kids out there. I mean, they were just coming to my classroom. They would show up every day dirty, ragged, and hungry because half of them ain't even had breakfast yet, but they were so focused on learning that it just... Well, it just made you feel good.
Mr. President. LBJ.
Yeah, it's my little interpretation of him.
Well, before we conclude, each of you just say something about the opportunity that EPCC has given you in both this competition and just in general. You know, you're going to have to go back to El Paso and, mm-hmm. you know, the lights of Broadway will be out. Yeah. You know, you'll remember being here, all that.
El Paso Community College has given me the greatest opportunity ever to come to New York City 2 years in a row now and see in total 4 Broadway shows and giving me a glimpse of what I want my future to be. I know I want to end up here. And, you know, my directors, Keith Townsend, Joelle and Griano, have given me the best opportunity possible to do so.
I would have to agree. El Paso Community College has just given me so many opportunities that I couldn't even dream of, like if I was anywhere else. They give me a chance to go throughout the nation and perform, put my name out there, so hopefully one day I can transfer and then hopefully follow my dreams at whatever university I end up at. Hopefully, fingers crossed, end up here.
Definitely has given me a lot of opportunities. It opens up so many doors, especially to theater. And, I mean, you're constantly traveling, so you meet so many people, and like DJ said, you get your name out there, and it's an amazing feeling.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
And are all of you graduating?
Yeah. 2 of us are. Charles and I are. And then Diego and Crystal have one more year.
All right. Well, the best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Crystal, Diego, Charles, and Sean are students from El Paso Community College. There is a whole lot more at thetakeaway.org/community college. We have an interactive community college map. You can find out where yours is and how it's performing. We have images, audio, and links to help you find more. That's at thetakeaway.org/community college. And here's something to take with you today. Did you ever wonder how many calories worth of Christmas cookies Mr. Claus consumes on an average Christmas Eve? Well, luckily, the folks at Greatest.com do have an estimate. If each household in the world leaves two cookies out for Santa, he'll be eating around 170 calories per house. That's 374 billion calories in total, a lot more than the 2,000 calorie per day intake recommended for Santa Claus by the FDA. Now, luckily, Santa Claus is magical. He doesn't need to worry about things like this. But for us mere mortals, what would it take to burn off that many cookie calories? 109,000 years of running an 8-minute mile without eating a thing. Bowl of jelly, indeed. Thanks so much for listening. Happy Christmas Eve. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding cancer research across the continuum, from basic research through clinical trials to advanced therapies that save thousands of lives. More information is available at lls.org. And Squarespace, providing tools to create a professional website. Learn more at squarespace.com/takeaway. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.